The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 477, recorded on September 10th, 2017. Hello, and welcome to 477th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and 310th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
I am TJ Denzer.
And I am Scott Dirk.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and has a gaming flashback. So before we get into the gaming flashback, what have you been playing, TJ?
I'm a sucker. I'm a sucker for pain. I got Destiny 2.
Oh, okay. Well, guess what? There's Destiny 2 news, but that'll come back. That'll come later. Did you ever, now when you say you're a sucker, did you have trouble getting logging on? Were you in the wait lines?
No, you know what? I took a day. I didn't get it at the midnight release. And, when I got in there, everything was fine. Like, I think a few of my friends on the West Coast were saying they were still having issues, but, and I'm not sure if that was PC or PS4, but I haven't had an issue getting in there yet.
You should have seen what it was like when I was among the first people to log into World of Warcraft. 5,000 people trying to kill kobolds for their candles in the opening thing. It was madness. What you got it for, a PS4 or PC or what?
I got it for PS4, and I gotta say, I'm having a better time. There's more story. There's people to actually care about. It's not in a card system that you turn off the game and go look up on the interwebs at thebungie.com, which I like having my game in my game. That's good. It feels more engaging on a lot of levels. And
I've already finished the game and said that the story is a lot better from beginning to end. So at least you have that to look forward to.
Yeah, it's not an incredibly long story, but it's a better story. I'll take quality over quantity for what it's worth. It's not incredibly short, but I'm enjoying it so far.
In combat?
Yeah, the combat is the combat was never really the issue with the old one. They did a good job on the combat. Really, you think so?
The guns felt didn't feel good. The enemies were boring. The same colors are used over and over and over again everywhere. It was like, please, how about something other? I'll kill for blue. Can you give me the color blue?
I'm tired of brown and
dark red.
If you're looking for blue, then they got a lot of blue in this one. There is entire worlds of blue. They have been listening to Jonah Falcon on the blue because
Are the locations a lot less boring? Because I remember playing, it's, oh, you get to go to Earth. Oh, it's just Russia. That's it. Oh, you don't get to go to Saturn.
Yeah. You get to do, there's funner locations in this one. They skipped out on the moon, which was just dark craters full of caves, and they actually put this one on Titan, Jupiter's moon, where it's literally like an offshore a giant offshore oil platform sitting on top of an ocean of electricity.
Shouldn't it be an ocean of methane? Oh well, this is the future, you know.
But it's gorgeous. Like, the backgrounds are fun. The skyline is fun. The actual geography is fun to explore. I'm having a good time with it. I'm turning around. Hater TJ, Mr. I hate Destiny. Don't make me play that game ever again. Is flipping the switch on Destiny 2.
Okay. Here's the thing. We had to delay the podcast for a week because of stuff. Last week, I was going to say the game that I've been playing was Papers, Please. I finally broke down and purchased it, and I found out how much fun I was having detaining people. I was channeling my inner Yahtzee Croshaw and saying, oh, you don't have a passport? Well, meet these nice men with guns. They're going to take you to the motel where you're never going to leave.
That game is a very, very interesting social experiment of who you are as a person.
I think I'm a bad person because I knew these people weren't real.
For me, it was upsetting to me, like just like the Well, for one, it felt like work. It felt like real life bureaucracy to the point of like I was just sitting there staring at it like, I don't think I can continue to do this. It's killing me inside.
Things are better if
I think that was part of the point.
Yeah, I think it's better when it's on easy mode. I mean, I played the regular mode, said, okay. I played the easy mode, said I was able to get the level 5 apartment and all that stuff. I was able to take in the niece without saying, no, sorry, I'm going to boot you to the wolves because I can't afford you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I had another friend that like played it like that, just like complete machine coldness. Like his goal was to see how many people he could get through in a day and how many people he could legally detain in a day to the point of like
– I did detain because you know what? When you detain someone, you don't have to hand their papers back. They just go away automatically. It's a lot easier. Just here, meet these people with guns. Your paper vanishes. I don't have to hand you back.
You don't get marked off because I know there's supposed to be some people.
If you you have to reject it, but then you have to give them all their bad paperwork back.
Yeah, there is a penalty. It has to be a legal rejection. If you reject someone and their papers are in order, you get penalized for it and you lose money. And money is everything in that game.
And I never fell. Look, at some point you. This weird cult pops up and they start offering you $10,000 and $2,000. I did not touch that with a 10-foot pole. That was schmuck bait right there. You'd have to be stupid to accept that money.
Mm-hmm.
You think they're not gonna find? I know. I'm very genre savvy. I know what's gonna happen if I take that money. Forget that. Right now, I'm doing another playthrough just to see how long I can get perfect, so that when the Commandant first appears. Even if you get like 2 or 3 wrong over the pace of a couple of weeks, he'll still chew you out. I want to see what happens if you've made no errors, and he does, so he can't say, it looks like we made a mistake in hiring you. Screw you, I'm perfect so far. Let's see what happens. And I'm getting very good at it. You know, I also noticed a pattern. I mean, after a certain point, you never see anybody with late, you know, expired documents, or you never see forged documents after a certain point, because I think it's sort of like, okay, you did that test, now let's see this other test. I mean, I start looking more and more at height and weight, you know, and I really enjoyed just detaining people because they had drugs on them.
There's
those drugs are for me. That kooky old guy, yeah.
I think every one of us that have ever played that game ever has like our own little system for it, where you like you got your layout of the rule book sitting there on the table. And the new note of the new rules and like just like everything you need to know, just like sitting nice and tidy on that table, exactly where you need it when you need it.
I'm gonna have to get a printout of the cities in each country, because I hate having to go to the book just to make sure that city's in that country. I mean, it never changes, so I might as well do that. So after Papers, Please, in the past few days, I got War of the Chosen for XCOM 2.
What do you think?
I made the mistake initially of combining the two, the two expansions that were with XCOM 2 with this game, because then it became a cluster crap. And while I can't fight the Chosen and the Viper Kings and all those people at the same time, damn it. So I just turned off the prior two expansions, just did War of the Chosen by itself. And so far it's pretty good. I like the Bond mechanic in which your soldiers can start, you know, a pair of soldiers will start working well together. I'm pretty sure that they get married at some point. I'm hoping that in this playthrough, now they have a better, I'm gonna see what happens when two males are bonded and two women are bonded, if they're gonna allow them to get married. I'm probably sure they will.
I just want my Maverick and Goose Top Gun team to be out there.
I noticed that the two people from two factions bond right away. It's like the game saying, yeah, you can see where this relationship is heading. Because they start cursing each other out at first, and then they say, oh, you're a pretty good fighter. I know, I've seen this movie before. I know what happens next. They're going to be best buds, you know? And, of course, you have to have a mission in which you rescue one of them. Just to prove, I really love you. You know, so there's that. I like a lot of the... some of the changes. Like, it's a nice little touch that you're allowed to take photographs of successful missions. Especially the flawless ones. So I'm only like 2 days into it, and I'm doing it, you know, very you know, not as a, you know, not, I'm not one of those people who burns through games. I'm sort of like savoring it, you know. And the thing with XCOM is it always has the definitive end, and I usually don't want to get there too fast. And finally, another game that I've been playing, I can hear people typing. Another game I've been playing is Cooking Dash, which is a free-to-play game. And I'm going to tell you something. It's a microtransaction game, but man, it knows how to steal your money. Because it does a really soft sell. It's like, you want 10 gold? Okay, 99 cents. And if you want more, if you want, like, 30 gold, it's the same price. It's $2.99. So it's not like you're going to miss out, you know, by buying. You know how it is sometimes. Sometimes you get more for paying a little bit more. No, it's the same exact amount. So it's sort of like saying, well, you know, you're not going to get more for getting the $2.99, so you might as well just get the 99 cent. But then the 99 cent, 99 cent, and then it's like that money will build up, and I'm making sure that I keep control of my finances here, you know, because it's so easy to spend money, and they make it easy to. The gameplay is fine, but, you know, I regret opening some of the things. Like, they have one called Adventure Ways, and it's Mesoamerican, and basically you're making chocolate-covered beetles and fried slugs and liquefied tentacles. I mean, oh, come on. I didn't want to do Cooking Dash for that. It's like, what? I really wish that they would allow you to relearn a recipe, you know, because when you first have to learn a recipe, they show you how to do it, and then they don't show it to you, even if you're playing that mission in which you were actually first shown it. I wish they would allow you to redo it so that you can say, oh, okay, that's how it is, because it's fine in some of the regular, but they had the VIP lounge, in which you can get a lot of gold and a lot of bonuses, but there's one dish that, you know, I forgot, and it's complicated, and I thought, can you please show it to me again? So there's that. I mean, it's a minor quibble. I'm actually more addicted to it than Animation Throwdown now. I'm trying to see how long I can go before I spend another 99 cents to get some more gold or money or whatever, you know? It's insidious. This is the danger of microtransactions, folks, when they do it right. Because you don't know you're spending a lot of money until you've spent a lot of money. And oh, shoot, I spent a lot of money. It's not like, oh, here's $20 and buy this. No, it's a dollar. Just 99 cents. Half a price of a cup of coffee, you know? Or actually, in some places, a quarter price of a cup of coffee. But you know what I mean. It's actually less than a bag of chips, you know? So it's very insidious. Anyways, it's very colorful. I mean, if you like Diner Dash, it's from that family. Except now you're making recipes. So you're not just having to serve people their dishes, but you actually have to make the dishes. Okay, to make a beef taco, you have to chop up the beef, make the taco, combine the beef and the taco, then put the entire thing into deep fry so that you can have the deep fried beef taco. You know, that sort of stuff. So that's fun. It's great if you're into the Diner Dash. If you're not, you may not like it. Anyway, Scott, what have you been playing?
I've been playing the game of Drive Up Florida for a whole day and Escape Irma.
I was about to say, are you doing this from your house, which is now underwater?
No, I'm in Georgia right now at my sister's place.
Oh, okay. That's cool. And then you'll just get a lot of heavy rain instead of having a tree go through your living room.
So, yeah, that's what I'm worried about.
And they're playing Minecraft. I assume you're going to jump in later.
Oh, yeah. I'm here and playing Minecraft at the same time.
Okay. So, anyways, we're going to go to our gaming flashback. And TJ, I'm pretty sure you know this game. Go ahead and do it.
Assassin's Creed! Assassin's Creed is an action-adventure stealth video game developed by Ubisoft Montreal and published by Ubisoft. It is the first installment in the Assassin's Creed series. The game was released for PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 in November 2007. And was made available on Microsoft Windows in April 2008. The player primarily assumes the role of Altair, as experienced by protagonist Desmond Miles. The primary goal of the game is to carry out a series of assassinations ordered by Al-Malin, the leader of the Assassins. To achieve his goal, the player must travel from the Brotherhood's headquarters in Masyaf across the...
Masyaf. There's a lot of Arabic names in here.
I know, and I'm butchering them. I'm sorry to everybody. across the terrain of the Holy Land, known as the Kingdom, to one of three cities, Jerusalem, Acre, or Damascus, to find the Brotherhood agent in that city. There, the agent, in addition to providing a safe house, gives the player minimal knowledge about the target and requires them to perform additional reconnaissance missions before attempting the assassination. These missions include eavesdropping, interrogation, pickpocketing, and completing tasks from informers and fellow assassins. Additionally, the player may take part in any number of side objectives, including climbing all tall towers to map out the city and saving.
Anyway. They didn't have to force me to do it. That was the best part of the game.
Absolutely. And saving citizens who are being threatened or harassed by city guards. There are also various side quests that do not advance the plot so much as hunting down and killing Templars and flag collecting. After completing each set of assassinations, the player is returned to the Brotherhood and rewarded with a better weapon and then given another set of targets, with the player free to select the order of certain targets. The player is made aware of how noticeable Altair is to enemy guards, as well as the current state of alert in the local area, via the social status icon. To perform many of the assassinations and other tasks, the player must consider the use of commands distinguished by its type of profile. Low-profile commands allow Altair to blend into nearby crowds, pass by other citizens, or other non-threatening tasks that can be used to hide and reduce the level of alertness. The player can also use Altair's retractable blade to attempt low-profile assassinations. High-profile commands are more noticeable, include running, scaling the sides of buildings to climb to higher vantage points, and attacking foes. Performing these actions at certain times may raise the local area's awareness level. Once the area is at high alert, the crowds run and scatter while guards attempt to chase and bring down Altair. To reduce the alert level, the player must control Altair as to break the guard's line of sight and then find a hiding space, such as a haystack or rooftop garden, or blend in with a citizen sitting on benches or wandering scholars. Should the player be unable to escape the guards, they can fight back using swordplay maneuvers. The player's health is described as the level of synchronization between Desmond and Altair's memories. Should Altair suffer injury, it is represented as a deviation from actual events of the memory rather than the physical damage. If all synchronization is lost, the current memory that Desmond is experiencing will be restarted from the last checkpoint. When the synchronization bar is full, the player has the additional option to use Eagle Vision, which allows the computer-rendered memory to highlight all visible characters in colors corresponding to whether they are ally, blue, foe, red, or even the target of their assassination, which is gold. Due to Altair's memories being rendered by the computer of the Animus Project, the player may experience glitches in the rendering of the historical world, which may help the player to identify targets or can be used to alter the viewpoint during endgame scripted scenes should the player react fast enough when they appear. An Assassin's Creed film featuring completely original characters was released on December 21st, 2016, and was god-awful.
Which starred everybody's favorite robot, David. The thing about synchronization, you could also desynchronize by killing people that you weren't supposed to kill. Or walk into didn't have the invisible wall so much as if you kept on walking out of the gameplay area, it'll tell you that you're walking out of the simulation. I remember the big controversy that they let, that the secret that the entire game was actually a virtual reality synchronization in someone's head. I think it was Jade Raymond who accidentally revealed that plot. Assassin's Creed is interesting because it is not a good game, but it's not a bad game. It has a lot of great ideas. And it was what, they took all the feedback that people had from the game to make Assassin's Creed 2. And I also remember that everybody was complaining, developers were complaining about people not buying Assassin's Creed for $30 and $20 when it was old, or renting it. And my response was, well, look how many of those people went on to buy Assassin's Creed 2. Assassin's Creed ended up being a demo for, as a matter of fact, I rented Assassin's Creed, then bought it. I said, this is interesting. I'll do it. Unfortunately, this is also when Ubisoft decided that every single game of theirs was going to be open world from then on. This was the game that did it, folks.
Yeah, and To a certain extent, Assassin's Creed 2 was the one that set it in stone because it was definitely the more successful of the two. I remember people, like, one of my buddies that was into martial arts would talk to me at length about, like, how authentic the Altair's actual movements were in the game. Because he used a thing called Krav Maga, which is a Middle Eastern fighting style. I do believe, don't quote me on that. But he would often tell me about just like the leg and arm movements that he used and how similar that was to like how he was trained to do stuff. And I thought that was interesting, but also just like, God, this game, this series made it so that it made the open world game scene explode after Assassin's Creed 2 came out.
You know what Assassin's Creed had that the rest of the games didn't really have? And that was assassinations. And by that, I mean you really had to work to do an assassination. And when you did it, it was done perfectly. And then having to get away, that was the fun part, because everybody in the city would be after you, and it was almost impossible to get away really quickly. It was like you really had to dodge a lot. It was really hard to get away, and I loved that part. You know, you did your assassination in front of everybody and said, okay, I'm out of here, bye, and everybody would run after you. It was so fun. It was so tense, too. Now, in recent games, you tell your, okay, buddy, go kill him. Thank you. You do nothing. You just point out people you want killed. That's not fun. That's delegating the gameplay to someone else, to the computer. I too
love Hitman contracts.
I mean, it says something when the best thing that ever happened to this series is that you get to be a pirate in Assassin's Creed 4. But what the hell does that have to do with being an assassin?
Yeah. That is, like, to your point, this did put an emphasis on that, but what it also put an emphasis on was doing BS side tasks. I don't mind some side quests in a game, but oh my god, just like the amount of off story things to do in Assassin's Creed was at times cool and at other times just fucking overwhelming to the point where
why the flag collecting, damn it.
Yeah, it makes the game like it's taken a long time for people to realize that things like that just spread out across an entire like 40-hour game to make it 60 hours makes the game exhausting to think about. I don't want to play a game if I know I have to collect things.
It doesn't sound very fun.
Climbing was great.
Like an artificial inflation.
It is. It is an artificial inflation. I mean, the fact of the matter is you're there to do what makes being an assassin, and that's what makes it cool.
On the other hand, having that you climb to the highest places in each city, that was cool, and I really enjoyed it, just to see what kind of – because when you synchronize at the top of these things, you would do this little pan around to see the sights, and then, of course, you do one of the dumbest things, and that is dive into a bale of hay. Because as we know, diving a mile high into a single little bale of hay will prevent you from any sort of injury.
Yeah, I mean, if Scrooge McDuck can dive into a vault full of coins and survive, then why not?
What's funny is they did have a joke, I think it was in The Witcher 2, in which you had this dead guy clad in white next to a bale of hay, which is implied to be Altair. They tried it in this world, didn't work. Oh, they did have a crossover with Assassin's Creed, another game, and I forgot what it was all of a sudden. Oh, yeah, Final Fantasy XV has a crossover with Assassin's Creed.
Yeah, they're giving the main character an Assassin's Creed costume, and I don't know how I feel about that one.
Now, we have to say that the next Assassin's Creed is coming back because they were doing it on a yearly basis. And they took a year off, although you have to put that in an asterisk, because you also had the two Assassin's Creed games, Assassin's Creed Russia and Assassin's Creed China, which were basically Mark of the Ninja done as with Assassin's Creed and not nearly as well. Now we have Assassin's Creed Origins, which is taking place in Egypt, which is supposed to talk about the very beginning of the Assassin's Creed, of the Assassin's group, the Hashashin. So that should be interesting. Hello?
Yeah. I I'm interested in the new Assassin's Creed, if only because it does feel like it's more streamlined than the previous ones. And I say that by meaning, like, it looks like they've packed the world with more interesting things to come across, per se.
Hopefully not flags. And hopefully not collecting, what was it, feathers for your mother in Assassin's Creed 2? What was it again? It was feathers, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, I think there was.
I love my mother, but I don't love her that much.
I think one of the things was Da Vinci blueprints, wasn't it?
No, for your mother. Remember in Assassin's Creed 2, your mother was upset because her one of her kids was killed, and you were trying to make her feel better, so you collected feathers for her.
I'm not gonna lie, I block most of the stuff that we're talking about on my brain after I'm done with it. It frustrates me to no end.
Yeah, but here's the thing: I did do all the effort to get Altair's stuff in Assassin's Creed 2. All that stupid underground sewer and then these puzzles underground. I did them because I really wanted that Assassin's Creed suit for Ezio.
But you know, like, I really do think that as much as we've seen, like, open world games explode, the best thing that could have happened to the open world genre was Zelda Breath of the Wild, because it, like, it put up this precedent that your game shouldn't just be open world and full of space, but there should be lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of things in that space to keep you invested and keep you wanting to continue to explore.
You know, that's why people love Skyrim. I don't love it anymore, but just doing that exploration of a space. I will say, though, Batman sort of ruined Assassin's Creed by doing Assassin's Creed, but more. You know, so now Assassin's Creed has to deal with the Batman Arkham games. Although they're not coming out anytime soon. As a matter of fact, Kevin Conroy said there's not going to be any more, but he's an actor, not a producer. So, it has been upped. You know, the bar has been raised, and Ubisoft has to understand that Watch Dogs is never going to be good. And Mafia 3 was actually 2K, so I can't really talk to Ubisoft about that. But it'll be interesting. New Assassin's Creed. Anyways, we're going to move on to the first news item, and this is exactly where this is going to tie into what you were talking about earlier, or at least what I've been playing. Gaming news, Destiny 2 passes 1 million concurrent users, and this comes from GameSpot. Destiny 2 has had a strong start, it seems. Developer Bungie reported on Twitter that the shooter had more than 1.2 million concurrent users on September 10th. That's today. Presumably that figure covers the combined player bases on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. More than 1 million concurrent users is a massive figure. Destiny 2 servers had experienced some issues, probably due to the influx of users, but generally the game has been stable. To help servers from melting, Bungie introduced server queues, so some players in particular regions may have had to wait to log in. By comparison, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, and this is something we discussed 2 weeks ago, by the way, is one of the most popular games on the planet right now, recently passed 1 million concurrent users for the first time. That game, however, is only playable on one platform, and it's $30 instead of $60. Of course, it's coming out with an Xbox One. Destiny 2's player base stands to grow further still as the PC edition launches in October. Neither Bungie nor publisher Activision has announced any specific sales numbers for Destiny 2, but now we know it's over 1 million at the very least. Unless we have some really creative pirates. Last week, Bungie said that the game welcomed millions of players just 2 days after launch. The concurrent player figure for Destiny 2 or any game will always be lower than the strict sales number, so there's no way everybody who owns the game would play at the same time. Destiny 2 is available now for PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. The PC edition launches on October 24th at Blizzard's Battle.net service, which to me is interesting. Yes, I know Activision owns Blizzard, but Battle.net is World of Warcraft, Diablo, StarCraft, you know? So they're actually in that area.
That's interesting because we all know by this point that Activision and Blizzard, it is Activision Blizzard by this point, but I think this is the first time that I've ever heard them blatantly cross over with one another. Like, usually they keep most of their products very, very separate from one another.
Yeah.
And,
it was shocking for 2 weeks ago to hear that Battlegrounds actually surpassed Dota 2 in terms of concurrent users, because that, for PC gamers, you know, that is the I mean, for PC gaming, that is the standard, you know, and it's an incredibly popular MOBA, but you had a shooter, shooter surpassing it, and they have this, and it's on console too. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens when it's on. Now, here's the thing. I'm pretty sure you could, there's probably going to be PC, Xbox One cross-platform play, but Sony's going to be a pouty little person about it and not allow it on their system, even though Battle.net is a system set up to do this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see what Sony decides to do. I mean, at the end of the day, I would assume that they like making money, so maybe they'll bend on it a bit, but... And Destiny has always been like a PlayStation 4, a Sony that, first thing.
That's, yeah, well, here's the thing, is that sales for the first couple of months on Destiny, the first Destiny, were equal among Xbox and PlayStation. It wasn't until the unique content started coming to the Sony version that, you know, it started to skew, and it didn't skew that much. So, despite the backing, and Microsoft's been doing a lot of advertising for Destiny 2 as well, this has basically been a very platform-agnostic game, which is, you know, unusual and for the most part when one company, you know, has their logo on the game a lot. Yeah, so, like I said, I'm going to tell you right now, PC gamers have been talking about the first Destiny for ages.
Mm-hmm.
Almost indignant that it wasn't on PC. I mean, we've seen Game Watcher. Anytime a piece of Destiny news came out, it's like everybody would gripe and say, why isn't this on PC? Well, guess what? It's coming to PC.
It's another thing that's, on the matter of crossplay, it's another thing that's interesting because that's when you got to start talking about what features will be crossplay and what won't. Fact of the matter is, reaction times are always going to be better on a mouse and keyboard than they are on a controller when it comes to looking around.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here's the thing. I'm pretty sure it would be a lot better if it's just co-op, you know, where
that's what
you're
I
not
was saying.
Fighting another person, you know.
Like, and that's the thing. Is like, are people going to care about the crossplay features if you can't do Crucible, if you can't do the multiplayer competitive and crossplay? To a certain extent, yes, but also there are some people that are going to be BS over that.
One thing I found out about the PC version is that they're removing most of the recoil because it makes no sense on a mouse and keyboard. So the recoil that you have when playing with a controller, you know, when you're firing a gun, it's not going to be in the PC version.
That's
odd. Or at
least
very, or at the very, very least, it's going to be de-emphasized a lot.
Hmm. Interesting, because recoil is most definitely a factor in games like Rainbow Six.
Yeah. But this is Bungie we're talking about, so... Anyways, let's move on to the next item. Go ahead, TJ.
Half-Life writer posts possible Half-Life 2 Episode 3 plot from Polygon. Half-Life writer Mark Laidlaw, who left Valve in 2016... may have just revealed the proposed plot of Half-Life 2 Episode 3 on his personal website in a post entitled Epistle 3? Is that right?
Yes.
Laidlaw presented what appears to be a thinly veiled summary of Gordon Freeman's long-missing adventure in the form of correspondence from someone named Gertrude Fremont. Laidlaw left Valve about 18 months ago after nearly two decades with the company. And the remaining portions of the letter detail what appear to be Gordon Freeman's final adventure, bookended with subtle acknowledgement about the situation surrounding Episode 3 and Valve itself. The story of Epistle 3 details the journey of Gertrude Fremont and Alex Vaunt to the Antarctic to find the mysterious ship known as the Hyperborea. Stand-ins for Gordon.
Hyperbia. Yeah, I guess you're right. Hyperborea. Okay, never mind.
Well, it makes sense to me, like Borealis, if they're in the Antarctic. Yeah. But stand-ins for Gordon Freeman, Alex Vance, and the Borealis, the research vessel designed by Aperture Science that was revealed in Half-Life 2 Episode 2. During the adventure, they encounter the Combine, Dr. Wanda Bree, a revived Dr. Wallace Breen, and Mrs. X, the G-Man. Laidlaw described the work as a gender-swapped fanfic on Twitter, calling the story a quote, gender-swapped snapshot of a dream I had many years ago. He also addressed the mysterious relationship between the G-Man and Alex Vance, saying, I had no fixed ideas about this, just planting seeds. This is something that Valve might still want to develop, flesh out, and explain someday.
Now, one thing is that the reaction from the community has been embracing this whole wholesale. At this point, they don't really care about getting the game. They just want a conclusion to the story. So this gave them some sort of closure, knowing what the story was going to be.
Yeah, and I mean, we mentioned it a little bit earlier about Player Unknown Battlegrounds overtaking Dota. I think one of the best things about that is that it's one of the first games to overtake a Valve game on Steam, and I think that's a good thing. I think if Steam knows that they can lose their edge on their own platform, I think if Valve knows that they can lose their edge on their own platform, it might push them to try new things, which would open the gates for this Half-Life opportunity.
Well, here's the thing. According to Valve employees, several of them, Valve doesn't want to do Half-Life 2 Episode 3 because it would be so scrutinized, and they saw what happened to Mass Effect 3, and they saw the death threats, and they saw this, and they saw the doxing and all that stuff, and they said, no, we don't need that. You know, we're making money as it is, and it, you know, the amount of money that we would make would be almost break even in terms of, you know, in terms of what it's worth. And they just don't want to put themselves through that, you know, which tells me, you know what, in 10 years, in 20 years, they might actually do the game when no one really cares about it. You know, or at least there's, you know, or a new generation is out, so that there isn't as much hype surrounding it. They just, you know, and this is why we can't have good things in the gamer community, because we're all, because vast majority of them are entitled little whiny bitches. I'm sorry, but it's true. I mean, look at the entire thing with Shadow of War right now. It is the most asinine complaints, and sorry, Jim, you're wrong. Because there's nothing in that game you can't get by earning it. And you've played Plants vs. Zombies Garden Warfare 2. It's the exact same method, you know? And if someone wants to be lazy and get things by paying for it, fine. You know? It doesn't affect my gameplay. And there's no... Although I will say the multiplayer in it is really intriguing. They take the Vendetta system from the first game and multiply it, in which now you can attack your friend's fortress. Not literally go into their... you know, have a version of their thing, and what's called, they get notified when you attack their fortress and what you did to it, you know, but nothing actually really happens to their fortress in their actual game. It's sort of like, aha, I screwed up your castle, what you gonna do about it? but, you know, I really don't care about Episode 3. You know, I mean, it didn't come out after 2 years, I lost all interest. You know, and I was losing interest in episode 2 anyway, but when it took a year and a half, you know, on something that was supposed to be an episode. You know why they have episodic content? Because you have to do it like Telltale does it. Every 4 or 6 weeks, you get the new episode. I mean, by the way, Batman, the second episode's coming on September 24th, I believe. I don't know. Do you really care? Do you really want to? Do you really care if Half-Life 2 episode 3 ever comes out?
I think by this point, like, I will agree with you on one matter about the stress behind that idea. I think that the idea of Half-Life 3 is far greater than the actual thing would ever be.
We're not even talking about Half-Life 3, we're talking about Episode 3.
Well, I mean, yeah, but that's what I'm saying, though, is, like, I think the idea that that the gaming community over the years has built up for this end-all, be-all chapter to their favorite thing ever, I mean... What game developer wants to try to reach for that ceiling? I can't imagine anyone that wants to, like, take on that stress willingly. Yes, we all want to make a creative, they want to make a creative thing, and they want to impress you, and they want to make something cool that you'll say, yes, I want to play this. But to immediately go into an expectation that you're going to be hated by someone because you didn't meet their almighty standard of what this ought to be as they imagined it over the course of 10 years. Oh God, it sounds like a nightmare.
So basically they've never had a conclusion is what's the issue. It seems like they just,
okay. Spoiler alert.
Went rope by the seat of the pants.
Spoiler alert. Well, no, Mark Laidlaw had an idea of what was going to be, what the story was. So Half-Life 2 episode 2 ended with the cliffhanger that, Dr. Vance, Alex's father, was brain sucked and killed by one of the advisors. Was it called the, no, was it called an advisor? A combine advisor. I think that, yeah, it was called combine advisor. And, the game ended with her crying over her father's corpse. And that was the last we ever saw of the series. So yeah, there was a lot of wondering what the hell was going on. I mean, Judith Mossman was reporting from the Borealis in the middle of the game, which hinted at where the game was going to be going. And, you know, I wonder if, you know, it's funny because to me, Portal 2 was more of a sequel to Half-Life Episode 2 than anything else. Because they both exist in the same universe. Mm-hmm. If you notice, the Borealis was designed by Aperture Science.
Yeah. So,
anyway, I don't know. Like I said, I really don't. And here's the dirty little secret. Half-Life 2 isn't really all that good. It's nowhere near as good as Half-Life 1 was. The enemy AI stinks, and the biggest thing about it is better graphics and a physics engine. But physics engines are not, you know, I could see, yeah, so what? You place a concrete block so that you raise the seesaw one side. Big, even then I was saying big whoop. It was impressive. But no one ever did anything with a Source engine. I mean, all we had was Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines and the Half-Life games, and that's it.
The biggest thing to ever come out of Half-Life 2 was Garry's Mod.
And yeah, that's true.
A fact.
Well, also, no, Counter-Strike came from the Half-Life mod. Never mind. There was some. Wait, wasn't Left 4 Dead out of the Half-Life 2 mod as well?
No. Left 4 Dead was its own thing. It was its own engine, Director engine.
Okay, I was just wondering because it's one of the titles that Valve said, "Oh, you're making that? Well, that looks nice. Let's do something with it." That's what I love about Valve. Unlike Nintendo, if someone does a mod or something based on their game, they're not like, "Oh, copyright." No, they say, "That's great. You have to, if you want to sell it, you have to give us a portion of the money." Look, the Half-Life 1 remake. Oh damn, I forgot. I have it too. You know the game I'm talking about, right? The Half-Life remake that was done with the Source engine. It was really made. Oh god, I have to look this up now.
Remake. Was it the
Black Mesa?
Oh, okay.
Black Mesa was a third-party remake, which was basically a fan remake. And Valve looked at it and said, "Hey, you know what? That's pretty good. You can sell it on Steam, and we'll take a profit of it." Nintendo, you know what Nintendo would do? Stop. Don't do that. How dare you grow the fan base? How dare you? We're going to throw a DC Mesh Strike on you.
Yeah. Thankfully, Sega got on board with Sonic Mania.
Yeah, that's true. And here's the thing. Sonic Mania started out as a pure fan project, and Sega said, "You know what? Our Sonic games have sucked. Why don't you make you're making this Sonic game, which seems pretty good. Let's sell it so that we don't destroy our own IP." Anyways, yeah. We're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
Okay, hold on a second.
American McGee.
I will get to it. Okay. American McGee is ready to make Alice 3. This is from Destructoid. American McGee is riding high after his successful Kickstarter campaign for the Out of the Woods card game. He's so high that after saying plans for a new Alice game were out of his hands, he's ready to take control of the franchise once more, sending out a tweet at the very reasonable hour of 2:25 a.m., McGee announced he's polishing off a proposal to EA for the third game in the series, tentatively titled Alice Asylum. It states, "Want a new Alice game? I'm starting work on a proposal. Come along for the adventure and lend your support." McGee has set up a mailing list for anyone who wants to follow along, but this could be threequel. He's also planning to set up weekly live streams where his fans can give feedback to the pre-production team. So that sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, so the thing is that he can't make an Alice game that's alike as a previous Alice games because EA owns the copyright for that. So basically what he has to do is he has to write a proposal to EA saying, "This is what I want to do." And EA can either say yes or no, although I'm going to say this. If I would guarantee EA might say, okay, what you can do is you can start up a Kickstarter project. If you can set up this amount of money, we'll match that money and then we'll do a production of it so that EA cuts down on costs. And, I wasn't a big fan of the Alice games. And I always thought, you know, making a warped version of Alice is like making a warped version of a warped thing, because Alice was always warped. It was, you know, without any, without any changing of it. What do you think, DJ? Are you into more Alice?
I like American McGee as a creative. He is one of the original Doom team. He clearly has the vision to make cool things.
I didn't make that katana.
I don't know, he's not sounding enthusiastic here.
I think that I agree with you. I think Alice is sort of like taking all the ugly parts of Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass and like bumping them to 11 and like taking it from what was always a subtle thing and making it extremely blatant, which is sort of lowbrow, I would say.
Well, Alice in Wonderland, the original Lewis Carroll thing, was a symbology for dreams. Alice and Alice Madness Returns is about being batshit crazy, you know. So that's the basic, you know, and not in a fun way either. I mean, disturbed crazy, you know, being in a mental asylum. So, you know, they're coming from two different places. But on the other hand, you know, I would like to see something that's not cookie cutter. I mean, Alice by itself is pretentious cookie cutterness in its own right, but at least it's different than what's out now, you know. So, And it'd be interesting to see how many people really want to see an Alice 3. You know, put your money where your mouth is if they do a crowdfunding project.
Yeah. I would love to see some of the art on that, because I know that when he gets behind something, he really does come out with some sort of twisted and interesting imagery. And
here's the thing.
I know it's going to be that sort of like, yes, this is blatant. Alice is nuts. But at the same time, he will also come out with cool things.
And you know what? American McGee did had been planning his version of Oz, called Oz Zombie. And you know what would be nice is to see if he does a little crossover with Alice 3. Have Alice go into the wonderful into the world of Oz. I mean, that would be interesting to see. I mean, it would kill two birds with one stone for him.
Yeah. Yeah,
they had some really disturbing photos of what the Oz characters would look like in his world that he did.
Mm-hmm.
Some mock-ups.
Go ahead, do it. If people are willing to shell out the money, then why not?
So we're going to move on to the next item. Settlers of Catan is coming to virtual reality this year, and this comes to us from The Verge. Iconic board game Settlers of Catan is coming to virtual reality. A new version is being developed by the game studio Experiment 7, which previously created a pair of VR games based on chess, with feedback on the original minds from Catan. The VR game, which is coming to both Oculus Rift and Gear VR, and is simply called Catan VR, is described as, quote, true to the classic, but optimized for virtual reality, with a fresh, fully immersive format, unquote. Unfortunately, right now, the creators aren't showing off what the new VR title looks like, though it appears... Unfortunately, right now, the creators aren't showing off what the new VR title looks like, though it appears that it'll feature both a single and online multiplayer component. Catan was first released as a physical board game back in 1995, and slowly built up a huge following. And by the way, when I say huge, I mean huge. Catan basically launched the entire Eurogame, gaming that we have now. It's been sold more than 20 million copies and been ported to multiple digital platforms, including consoles and smartphones. Oh, by the way, including that stupid handheld, the game Zeebo. there's even talk of a movie. Now, here's the thing. If they can make a movie about Clue, they can make a movie about anything. I'd be hard-pressed to think of how they would make a game, make a movie out of Settlers of Catan. The first time I saw Catan on the magic table, I was fascinated by what VR has to offer, creator Klaus Teuber said in a statement. The game I made in our living room with my family 25 years ago in virtual reality, it's incredible. The VR version of Catan is expected to launch this holiday season. While debut on Rift and Gear VR, there will be quote unquote additional VR platforms to follow, which I don't doubt because they no longer have that exclusivity to, oh, this is for Oculus Rift and this is for Vive. No. They say it's for everything. Because when you're trying to do the virtual reality, you can't afford to have different hardware platforms have their own, you know, exclusives.
You know what's really cool about the idea of doing a board game in VR? It means that if you go into doing expansions and additional, like, you know, pieces, new rules, new add-ons for it, you don't have to go through the production side of creating new miniatures, new cards, new art. Well, you have to create the new art, obviously, but you don't have to go through all of the production that goes with that to a certain extent. And I think that's a really neat opportunity for virtual board games.
And the thing is that Klaus Teuber actually helped with doing the Xbox Live Arcade version of Settlers of Catan, which had a really brutal AI. So it's going to be interesting to see how much better the AI is going to be for this game. Here's the thing. Most people play their board games in reality, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's always nice to have a single player of something, and B, it's always nice to have a multiplayer thing of something. Mm-hmm. Now, I back Tabletopia as a gold member, so I have 100 years of gold membership. So when I'm 147, I'll have to think about redoing my resubscribing. But I would love to see this happen with other games like Scythe or, I already discussed this in a preview that I wrote for TMR Zoo with Bloody Zombies and how it was taking VR as if the game was on a table and you're playing your side-scrolling beat-em-up, looking down and looking. And this is the sort of VR that people can play without getting sick because it's not a first person. And it's another way to take advantage of the technology without having to, you know, because I know Scott was talking about how VR made people around him want to throw up.
Yeah.
Scott?
Yeah, we actually tried a VR game when I got up to Georgia. My sister has this Spider-Man, the movie Homecoming demo, and we tried it out, and it actually seemed to work fine and not really be dizzying. It was really immersive, and it was really cool and immersive, and I actually enjoyed it. So it was cool to, you know, experience some of the current VR stuff. It was a PlayStation Move, I think. It was PlayStation VR, or whatever it's called.
Well, it's called PlayStation VR, yeah.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
Yeah. And I want to expand a little bit on what I said before. I know that there are people out there that love the idea of the expansion sets, like new miniatures and being able to have that stuff in your hands, seeing the new game board and being able to hold that and open a new pack of cards, because the smell of a new pack of cards is one of the best smells in the world. That's all there is to it. But I think that adds on to cost, and like I know that's great for enthusiasts, but for those of the rest of us that want to play that game and play the expansions and continue to enjoy this thing, I think VR expansions into a board game are a really neat idea.
Well, I have Ticket to Ride on Steam, and if I want to buy, Switzerland, I don't have to pay $30 for it. I pay, I think, $5 for it. But on the other hand, you know, the entire point of playing a board game is that you're sitting there with your friends and you're interacting, you're picking up the pieces with your hands and you can feel the pieces in your hand and all that stuff. That's great. That's why people play board games and not video games sometimes, because you have that physicality, you know. I mean, until we get a holodeck, that's the only way you're going to be able to do it. But, you know, sometimes you can't play with other people because you're not everybody can schedule, and, you want to play online? Fine, you know, and you have the experience of having this three-dimensional representation in front of you, which is cool. I mean, like I said, it's not going to replace board games and vice versa. It'll be interesting to see how well this is picked up. Anyways,
yeah.
Scott, why don't you take the next item?
Okay, well, let's see. Act 1 of Homestuck Adventure Game, Hive Swap, coming out this month.
By the way, wait, stop. It's Homestuck.
Homestuck, sorry.
Right, you can start from the beginning again. Act 1 of Homestuck.
Act 1 of Homestuck Adventure Game, Hive Swap, coming out this month. This is from PC Gamer. It's been a long road to release for Hive Swap, point-and-click adventure set in the universe of the webcomic Homestuck.
Homestuck?
It received nearly 2.5 million of backing on Kickstarter back in 2012 before multiple planned release dates, first in 2015, then this January came and went. Well, now it's finally upon us, with the first episode coming out September 14th. Don't worry if you haven't read the comics, because you don't need any prior knowledge to understand the story. You play Joey Claire, a teen snatched from the mid-90s and transported to an alien world on the brink of rebellion. Developer What Pumpkin Games promises a love letter to 90s adventure games. So expect to pick up lots of items that you can combine in imaginative ways to solve puzzles. You will get a unique response from the game every time you try to combine any two given items, even if they don't work together, which is neat. The art is all hand-drawn, and as seen in the trail on the top of this post, really colorful, and its environments are packed with detail. Plus, the urgent music is courtesy of Toby Fox, who produced Undertale's excellent lo-fi soundtrack. Let's hope the puzzles live up to the presentation. Similar to Telltale's point-and-click games, decisions you make in Act 1 will influence your story in later acts, so choose wisely. Act 1 will cost $8, roughly $6.20 on Steam and on the Humble Store.
Sounds so cool. Do you guys read Homestuck?
It looks like.
Do I read it? No.
Okay. I do order the stick, and I'm waiting for a video game version of that. What is that snoring?
Tumbleweed did pretty good, so I hope this one does as well.
Okay. I would pay to listen to another game worth of Toby Fox's music. Undertale's soundtrack is fantastic.
I still haven't played Undertale, damn it. At some point I will.
It's got a good story, but like the soundtrack in that game, like that's one of the few video game soundtracks I actually keep in a folder on my computer at all times, so I can bust into it whenever I feel like it.
Anyway, we're going to move on to the next item. Go ahead, TJ.
Oh, jeez. Okay. PewDiePie threatened DMC takedown following his use of the N-word on stream. From Eurogamer. Felix PewDiePie Gelberg has once again come under fire. During a live stream of PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds earlier today...
Which is, by the way, September... Wait. We should say it's September 10th.
Yeah.
So start again with during a live stream.
During a live stream of PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds earlier, PewDiePie uttered, "What a effing N. Geez, oh my god, what the F. Sorry, but what the F." He then laughed off his choice of words, saying, "I don't mean that in a bad way." This isn't the first time PewDiePie has been shrouded in controversy, as earlier this year, Disney ditched its partnership with him following an anti-Semitic stunt. For Firewatch developer Sean Veneman, PewDiePie's use of the N-word was the last straw, and the game creator decided it didn't want the popular streamer profiting off its footage of its product. Sean said, "We're filing a DMC takedown of PewDiePie's Firewatch content in any future Campo Santo games," Veneman stated at the start of a multi-tweet rant. "I'm sick of this child getting more and more chances to make money off of what we make," the developer continued. "He's worse than a closeted racist. He's a propagator of despicable garbage that does real damage to the culture around the industry. Freedom of speech is freedom of prosecution. His stream is not commentary. It is ad growth for his brand. Our game on his channel equals an endorsement. Furthermore, we're complicit. I'm sure we've made money off of the 5.7 million views that video has, and that's something for us to think about." Veneman later clarified that the takedown hasn't officially been issued yet. As he said, "We'll see what our attorneys have to say about it tomorrow." Not everyone is as vehement as Veneman, as some PewDiePie fans have argued that he didn't mean it in a racial way, as his target wasn't black. where they've pointed to the charitable work the popular streamer has done in the past. And
the stream was taken down, but it's not known if he did it, if PewDiePie took it down himself, or if the DCMA was done, but it's out now. But yeah, that wasn't done in a racial way. Bullshit. I mean, how is it not in a racial way?
In any other way but negative or racial.
Anyone who is willing to throw that word out there in a moment of stress is comfortable with that word. And yeah, people might say, well, it's not that bad if you give that word power. It's like, but the fact of the matter is that the people that are impacted by that word have the choice to be affected by it. You don't get to decide for other people if they're affected by a word.
Also, you know what? Here's the thing. He has had a long history of this kind of crap. He does all this alt-right stuff while claiming not to be alt-right.
He's a shock jock.
Yeah, and here's the thing. You know what? I don't care if he's the quote-unquote number one YouTube personality, because that means nothing to me. Because here's the thing. Would you look at Lucas Cruikshank. He was the quote-unquote number one YouTube personality. And for those who don't know who Lucas Cruikshank is, he's Fred. You know? And if you don't know who Fred is, he's this guy who has who's like a teenager who acts like a 5-year-old with a really artificially high voice, you know, and he did it as, you know, just as a goof, but then he became really popular. And I don't really care what's popular on YouTube, because you know what's popular on YouTube? 10 to 12 year olds. There is no way to differentiate between who's watching the videos. You know? I don't care. Go ahead.
It matters to me that he's the top YouTube guy.
Well, just said something about YouTube. You know who else is top on YouTube? Schmosh.
But what I'm gonna say is he's not just an ambassador for YouTube. He's an ambassador for gaming. He's an ambassador for everyone who plays. He's an ambassador for everyone who writes. He's an ambassador for everyone who creates and develops. And for him to go out there and do that. People. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. Don't you think it's a bit of a problem that he would be the representative of YouTube? It wasn't like he did this campaign. No, he organically did it. He was popular because people think like him, and it's a really sad thought. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who like him are 12 years old.
Yeah. Well, because for someone like me who works every day to cultivate an environment of inclusiveness, to create an environment where everybody is invited and we are doing this because we love it, to hear about something like this is just like, it's devastating to me. It's devastating to my friends, and it's disgusting. It's disgusting for people to go out there and say, well, he didn't know what he was doing. Yeah. Well, you know what you're saying when you say that PewDiePie made a slip up? You're saying that either he's stupid and too stupid to know what he's doing, which first off is bullshit. That guy has been in the public eye for years. He knows what he's doing when he talks.
You know what?
And B, what?
Here's the thing. I have this thing about being online. I never say anything that I wouldn't say in front of other people in person. I would love to see him try and act like that, especially in, say, New York City. Especially, say, West 116th Street, and see some consequences for your actions, which would be a broken nose and maybe more.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know what? You're not anonymous, which is good. But you know what? You know, there's a reason why Disney shit-canned you when they actually looked at what you were doing. It's like Disney said, oh, he's really wait a minute. That's not what we want associated, even though our founder used to be a Nazi, or at least didn't like Jewish people.
One of the other things, too, is there's this subgroup of people out there that are saying that this DMCA takedown by Camposanto is illegal, or at the very least is not okay, because they said it would be okay for everyone to stream their game, and that's an abuse of the DMCA system. You have to understand, when you're an ambassador for a product, they have every right to pull their funding of you if they see that you're doing something ridiculous that smears their image.
Well, here's the thing. I forgot the name of the neo-Nazi site, but they got pulled down by their host because they started telling people no, not GoDaddy. It was Coldfire. And they said, well, you know, they started telling people that they were actually secretly in their, what's it called? They secretly agreed with them. And that got them shit canned because here's the thing. Coldfire is going to do a lot of things, but they're not going to allow people to tell other people that they're actually secretly neo-Nazis themselves. And that is a breach of contract, and they shit canned them. And it wasn't freedom of speech. It's, you know what, we were suffering you, and now you cross the line, so goodbye. And they now have web hosters in, guess where? Russia, which I'm pretty sure is very much in line with them. So here's the thing. You know, if you're not getting arrested for it, you don't have freedom of speech.
And the other thing is that, I mean, we've seen it in the game industry before. We may not agree with it, but a creator has the right to control their image. Nintendo does it all the time.
Here's the thing. I mean, you know the reason why Marcus Persson is no longer with Mojang for a long time? Because he's a creepy little neo-Nazi. And Mojang quickly swept him away, even though he was the face of Mojang for a very long time. He was Notch. But, you know, that wasn't going to fly, and Mojang knew it. And when they got rid of Notch, they actually were able to do a deal with Microsoft. Because Microsoft wasn't going to deal with Notch. No way.
No, of course not. I mean, that guy is... All you have to do is take one quick skim through that guy's Twitter, and it'll turn your stomach if you're if you're not prepared.
Especially now that he no longer has to worry about being seen as part of Mojang. He's free to be his old repulsive self.
But no, every day that we go out there, every day that we write something about games, every day we play a preview, it's a privilege. It's a privilege to be able to take a game and talk about it and do stuff with it and interact with developers. That's a privilege. That's not a right. That's a privilege.
And, you know, it's also
because those guys are the ones that are pouring their sweat and their blood into making this work. And they're the ones that at the end of the day have to eat what they've, who they've worked with and what they've put out.
And they basically said, you know what? If we're making money off you, we don't want your money.
Yeah. And it's at this point where they get to, they make the decision. Like in the past, they had to eat it. Like when he did the anti-Semitic thing with Fiverr, where he was paying people to put up, to hold up banners that said Hitler's cool, and not in those words, but it was essentially that.
I dare do it in Germany because they have very strict laws about that in Germany.
But I mean, they had to sleep with that. And finally, they've come to the point where they, enough is enough, and people should be able to say that. That's simply the way it is. Words have power.
It's a, you know, the internet is an illusion sometimes, because you go on the internet, you can find anybody who agrees with you on any topic whatsoever, and it'll make it seem like in your brain, hey, you know what, a lot of people, but no. Let me give you an example. You know, the neo-Nazi march, you know, they did, here's the thing about the Ku Klux Klan. There's a reason why they wear hoods. Because they don't want to be seen. They don't want to be identified. These 20-something morons go out and torches and all that crap so that everybody can see who they are. And they're shocked when they find out, you know what? 99% of the people there are going to shun you if you proclaim to be a Nazi. You know, and PewDiePie is learning, you know what? People don't like that stuff and they're going to shun you unless they're 12 years old and don't care.
Right. And I mean, to those people that would defend it, like, and say the words are just words and they have no power, if you think that words don't have any weight, then you're probably too stupid to realize why you got into PewDiePie in the first place, because marketing, advertising, and shock jock rhetoric are definitely based on words.
And, you know, George Carlin and Lenny Bruce dealt with this subject about, but their message was very clear. It's not the words themselves, it's the people who are speaking them. And they have to, what's it called? And they have to, what's it called? PewDiePie can't say, well, you know, what's it called? We don't judge the words, we judge you. You know, and it isn't like you did this, you have a long history, you know. This is not like, oh, you know, that was in a moment of weakness. No, 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 no. This is who you are. We know who you are. You know, you're part of Gamergate.
It was in a moment of comfort. It was in a moment of, I can say whatever I want because I'm not worried about the consequences.
Anyway, this news is really, really depressing and all that stuff. So we're going to move on to a nice happy topic. Okami HD spotted for PC, PS4, and Xbox One. This comes to us from Eurogamer. Our full adventure Okami looks like it's set to make a return on PC, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One later this year. That's according to a listing on the ever-reliable Korean ratings board, Virogamatsu, which regularly leaks upcoming announcements. Okami originally launched for PlayStation 2 back in 2006, before ports for Wii in 2008 and then the PS3 in 2012. It is critically acclaimed for its painterly cel-shaded logo, cel-shaded design, and for its lovable wolf protagonist, Amaterasu. This latest edition is again listed as HD, just as the PS3 version was 5 years ago, though you have to wonder if this HD is more like 4K compatible, you know, an HD. So, have you guys played Okami?
Yes.
Yes, I have. I played it on the Wii.
So tell us about it, Scott.
Well, on the Wii, your Okami is this wolf. I think it's a god or a demigod. And the world has been drenched in darkness, and you are set forth to bring light back to the world by painting it with the Wii controller. And this is one of those games that I thought worked very well with the Wii remote. The motion controls worked well in this game. And you would paint like slashes or circles or X's or lines to create things, vines, rafts, circles, even light itself. And it was a really fun game and very challenging. I found it challenging anyways. And it was a really nice story, and everything was like very like watercolor. And it had that like, that, Japanese art style, and it was very beautiful, and the music was great, and it was a really fun game. And I'd like to see how it works on other consoles that don't have motion control, because I think that Okami kind of needed that functionality.
You do have motion control. You have the PlayStation Wand, and you have I don't know how many people are going to use it, but you also have Kinect as well. And PC obviously has a mouse. So, and that's one of the things that a lot of people are going to be happy about, is that it's coming to PC. It's funny, you know, PC is getting all of these former console games, you know, being ported to them, like Bayonetta and stuff like that. TJ?
I played it on, there was a version on DS a while back, and I really enjoyed,
that was a spin-off, I think.
It was the puppy version of, Okami.
Of course it was.
And, but it had a lot of the same mechanics. I remember drawing on the lower screen with the stylus and doing a lot of those things, like casting spells with the art brush stuff, and that was just always, like, the aesthetic and the mechanic itself. Was just something that really lent it well to like a motion control or a stylus level system. It was one of my favorite things, and I think I would definitely play it again.
I might buy it for PC as well. I think I loved it that much.
They're gonna clean up the edges on that, which is really the only thing I can think I would want to see for that. But if they add some stuff on there, that would be neat too. I would love to see what they do with it.
I think it's just going to be a straight up remaster and see if there's interest in that franchise, you know, and see if more Okami games might come out.
Yeah, then like I said, I think I will buy it when it comes on PC.
Yeah, I can see them gauging interest on that. I mean, it is an extremely like almost niche sort of style of game and art style as well. I think a lot of people are into the cel-shaded style, but there's a lot of people that...
It's also Japanese art, too. Well. I mean, it's not just that it's cel-shaded, but it's also Japanese art.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway, look for our show notes. Go ahead.
I would want to use a tablet with this game. And I think the cel... Because usually I don't like cel-shading, but in this one, I think it worked very well because it went with the style, the art style.
And yeah, almost very much like a paper craft sort of calligraphy thing that was really neat about it.
Look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy your feedback, so leave us comments on our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us some iTunes comments. So I am at Jonah Falcon on Twitter.
I am at Johnny Chugs.
I am at Alpha Shard.
And we will see you next week, and hopefully... Scott has a home to come back to.
Yes, I'm very much hope there will be. I'm sure there will be. I think the power went out, so our food probably has to be thrown out. But other than that, I think it'll be fine. So happy gaming, everyone.
Hey, good luck, man. I hope everything works out for you. Play Thank games. You, TJ. Have fun. Be cool, everyone.
And we will see you next week.
Bye, guys.